Okay, so I think where I wouldn't mind beginning here is actually talking a bit about kind of, I mean, we talked a lot about, well, pardon me, in the media there's a lot of talk about the Arab Spring, but also running not long after that, there was also, you know, uprisings in Swaziland, Gabon, Cameroon, and Djibouti. So could you talk about those uprisings and sort of how they fit into this wider picture that we've been seeing with the Arab Spring and, of course, the Occupy movement?
Yes, sure. I mean, I think this is something that we've been trying to push an understanding of. We published recently a book called African Awakening, The Emerging Revolutions. The problem has been that the media has focused really on what they call the Arab Spring, forgetting that, of course, Tunisia and Egypt, where the main revolutions occurred, are actually in Africa and have had a long, long intimate relationship with the rest of Africa. But I think the extraordinary thing has been, and we've documented, that there must be, what, maybe 30 other countries where there have been major protests demonstrations and so on going on. You've mentioned some of them, but we're talking about Swaziland, we're talking about Malawi, South Africa, Zambia, Namibia, Uganda, and numerous other places. We've seen the recent uprisings in Senegal, which led to eventually the elections and the defeat of the incumbent president Wade. And the issue here is, well, why is this happening? Why is it happening now? And I think if one has a look at what the etiology is, what's causing this discontent, what you realize is that they have a lot in common, and the principal issues are that in most of Africa, countries have faced 30 years of neoliberal policies, which have resulted in massive decline in living standards, the opening up of the territories to the freedom of international capital for multinational corporations to exploit natural resources. There's been enormous amount of land grabbing. There's been grabbing of jobs. People have lost huge unemployment. In South Africa, for example, estimates are that we're talking about 40% of the population which is unemployed. And those are the kind of figures which are common throughout the continent. But the key thing to understand here is that, whatever one might say about the nature of the governments which came to power at independence in the 60s, the reality is that one of the greatest gains of independence, the most important gains of independence, was not just self-determination, but it was also the establishment of all kinds of services, health services, education services, access to water, telecommunications, and so on. These were gains of independence. This is what people fought for. This is what they lost blood and sweat and tears for. And in a very short period after independence, within 20 years, you went from a situation where there was absolutely no health service, no education service, none of these services under colonial rule, to a situation 18 years, 20 years later, where you had universal education, universal access to healthcare, and so on. There were major transformations. These were gains of independence. But by the 1980s, what has happened is that since the 1980s, the implementation of structural adjustment programs by the IMF, the World Bank, and by the CEDAWs of the world and so on, have resulted in a reversal of all those gains of independence. Everything has been privatized. Water is privatized. Electricity is privatized. Health services are privatized. Education is privatized. And you have a situation in almost every country across the continent, where the rich have got enormously rich through their collusion, collaboration with the international corporations. Meanwhile, the majority of the population has gone poorer and poorer. Standards of living today for ordinary working people is below what it was at independence. And that's true of the Rainbow Nation in South Africa as anywhere else. And I think that the situation now is one in which there is a major crisis of capitalism. We're entering a period of massive recession. Even Europe, the euro is for sure going to disappear up its own orifice. There's a very serious decline in the economy. But what this has led to, and I think this is what really leads to the kind of uprisings we've seen, is that there has been not just an economic crisis, not just a financial crisis building up, but there's a major crisis of confidence, crisis of credibility in the ruling elites, in the capacity of the ruling classes to deliver. And I think this is what has happened. There is a growing discontent across the continent. And it's not just those countries in the geographical territory of Africa. It is also places like Greece, Spain, Italy, and France will certainly join that soon. And we've seen the rise of the Occupy movement. All of these are movements which I think reflect the spirit of discontent, the growing spirit of discontent against the immiseration and the kind of neoliberal policies that have been put forward. And I think we are entering a period of very serious crises because, you know, our governments have now become more accountable to the multinational corporations, to the international financial institutions, to the banks, than they are to citizens. And I think this has led to a spirit of a growing consciousness, growing concern that we need to be able to reclaim our sense of our ability to determine our own destiny. Self-determination is one of the things that is rising across the continent. And I think it is also one of the motivating features of the Occupy movement. It may not be entirely clearly expressed in those terms, but you can certainly feel that people are saying, we have to find another way of living. We have to find other ways of making decisions. We have to work out ways which are based on equality, not on the greed of a minority. And so I think the Occupy movement's slogan of 99% against the 1% is a really important one, because it shifts the debate from the sort of nonsense charity stuff about development and poor people to one of saying, well, you know, there is no such thing as poverty. There is pauperization, there's impoverishment. So who is causing that impoverishment and who benefits from that? And I think that's one of the great things that is emerging. It doesn't mean, of course, that it's everything is going to be rosy as a result. I think, you know, we are going to be faced also with violence. We've seen that in Iraq. We've seen that in Afghanistan, where it's shameful that the Canadian government has been so involved in that. We've seen that in Somalia. We've seen it in Libya. We've seen it in Cote d'Ivoire. And I think it is something that we will see much more of in the coming period, with the American, the U.S. AFRICOM having, you know, its foothold in Africa, and it's a military presence. It's there to prevent any social turmoil which could challenge the interests of the international corporations.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. Because you highlighted the concentration of wealth and power and even more globally, but then also in Africa. So I'm curious, what are the status of some of these uprisings? I mean, have we seen, I think a number of them have been brutally repressed. So could you talk about that? I mean, where do some of these uprisings stand as of right now?
Well, I think you're seeing we have to sort of look at this in terms of like a motion picture rather than as a photograph. If you just take a photograph of people running on a street, you'll see some who are ahead and some who are behind. But if you actually see the motion, you will see that some are running slower than others. Others are facing opposition. They're being beaten down. I think, you know, Djibouti, for example, the uprisings there were crushed horrendously. Today in Egypt, you see mass demonstrations. Just last week, you had hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets. What you also have is essentially the military, which has taken control of Egypt and is seeking to use violence as a way to prevent the uprising from transforming that country. You're seeing the same thing in Tunisia. Over the weekend, we had demonstrations which were brutally attacked by the military there and by the police. And in South Africa, for example, over the last 5 years, the police report that they've had to deal with an average of 5,000 uprisings a year, which they've had to try to suppress. We've seen the burning down of shack dwellers' housings in Durban, in Cape Town. We've seen massive attacks against the homeless people, the landless people, and I think, you know, that confrontation is very real, and you know, it's shocking but not surprising that, you know, you find that, for example, in Egypt, the U.S. government has just recently given them a $1.3 billion military support to the Egyptian military, you know, under the pretense that they're supporting Egypt to achieve some kind of democracy. And I think that's what we're seeing, are these processes in motion. And the important thing, I think, is that our ruling classes, our elites in Africa, are so closely tied to and have a vested interest in the continuity of the situation, where they can fill their bank accounts and have offshore accounts and can steal money from the public purse with impunity. And they are closely tied to the corporations. They're closely tied to the banks and so on. And so we have a situation where our own governments are turning against their own people.
Yes. Now, I'm curious also, too, because, and I'm glad that you also raised the other point as well of the renewed activity of the United States in AFRICOM, you know, which has been involved in, I believe, East Africa, Central Africa, and then obviously in Libya. You talked about it, AFRICOM being sort of a force to sort of mitigate these sorts of things. Could you talk about that a little bit more and get a little more in depth about that, how you see this? Because, I mean, certainly, I mean, AFRICOM was created before a lot of these uprisings. How do you see that dynamic playing out, that this was sort of... I don't think that they had a crystal ball into seeing that these things would happen. But,
no, absolutely not.
But
the original motivation for AFRICOM was very, very clearly expressed in the early days, and that was to ensure that the U.S. would continue to have access to Africa's natural resources, in particular oil. And they had a very clear strategy that they wanted to be able to prevent the Chinese corporations and China from having access to that oil. I think that's one of the clear things that was expressed in its early days. They have tried to establish their headquarters in Africa, but none of the African governments, with the exception of Liberia, accepted their presence formally. But in reality, they have a presence throughout West Africa, throughout North Africa, and throughout East Africa and beyond. They have a presence on the ground, but I think we have to understand the nature of that presence. The very large proportion of AFRICOM's budget is actually spent in social sciences. It's really interesting. If you survey the American social science research, you'll see that a very large proportion of the research which they carried out by academics in the U.S. is funded by AFRICOM. So this is not just a military intervention. This is an ideological intervention as well. They continue to deny that they have military presence in various places. But only last week, the U.S. AFRICOM website announced that they had three soldiers killed, three AFRICOM soldiers killed in Mali. Now, what were they doing in Mali? It's an admission that they have a military presence on the ground. And there's been lots of information coming out of WikiLeaks, which illustrates that they have very intimate knowledge of movements like the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and there's evidence that they have been involved in providing some funding to these in order to cause disruptions in Mali. And there's even evidence that they've colluded with the former Mali government in such activities. So this is a military and an ideological force which is there increasing if it is to protect its interests, what it perceives as its right to Africa's resources, then to do so, it must be able to act both politically and militarily. And, you know, its presence in Mali is not to be underestimated. Remember that Mali is extremely rich in gold, extremely rich in oil. And it's worth noting that one of the biggest oil exploiters is a Canadian company called North Atlantic Resources, which recently announced that its 100% owned subsidiary, Celia Energy Limited, has been granted something like 7,500 square miles of Block 18 oil and gas exploration in Mali, right in exactly in the place where the Azawad movement has arisen and seeking self-determination. And these are the kind of corporations there, U.S. corporations, Canadian corporations, European corporations, who are seeking to have access to that wealth. And it is very clear that AFRICOM's task is to, as it were, ensure that these corporations will get what they want on terms that they want. And, you know, with the threat of a military power sitting in the background.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious because, as well, I mean, because you talked about the creation of AFRICOM and kind of to get at the resources before Chinese corporations do. I mean, I've read a lot about China's involvement in Africa, and it comes up quite frequently. Is China a legitimate challenge to the old colonial powers in Africa? I mean, is that something actually that substantial? China's involvement in Africa?
It could become substantial, but I think that the problem that China faces is that they entered the show late, and by the time they began the operations in Africa, most of the oil fields had already been seized by the American and European corporations. And so their entry into it has been quite problematic. They entered into Sudan only because the U.S. government banned Exxon and other companies from continuing their operations there. In Angola, when the IMF refused to provide funding to the Angolan government, the Angolan government turned to China and offered them rights to exploitation of oil there. And this has happened in a number of other places. But it still remains a small player in terms of natural resource extraction. If you look at, for example, in Nigeria, less than 5% of greenfield sites for oil are exploited by Chinese corporations. And people forget that, you know, if you look at foreign direct investment, for example, the UK is far larger than in fact it's the number one player in Africa, followed by the US and India and Canada are not far behind. And they still remain, in terms of foreign direct investment, much larger than China. But China is playing the game very strategically because, you know, they entered a period where the IMF and the World Bank, supported by the U.S., were saying that there was going to be no investment in infrastructure, no building of bridges, hospitals, and so on. The Chinese turned around and said, no, we'll build them for you. Which is what they've done. So they've built goodwill by entering and breaking the stronghold of the World Bank and IMF in terms of allowing infrastructure development. I think they're playing a very, very smart game. But which way it will end up is partly going to be determined by the kind of battles that are going on in the Chinese Communist Party at the moment as they face the renewal of elections and the new Central Committee, and there is a raging battle between the left and the neoliberals in China, which is pretty fierce and horrendous, and that will determine the kind of directions that China will go in the future in Africa.
I'm curious too. I mean, because I always wonder, because I hear a lot of that kind of stuff, of China building goodwill and doing, you know, specifically people on the left, commentators on the left always say, well, you know, in comparison to what the colonial powers did, I mean, China is doing great work. Is it all that great? Is it all building schools, roads, and bridges, or is there a darker side to some of this stuff that China's doing?
Well, I'm just curious. It's really interesting. I mean, we must get our vocabulary right here. You know, when ExxonMobil or Shell or whichever company exploits in Africa, we always refer to the company. We don't say it's the Americans doing it or the Canadians doing it. We don't say Canadians in Africa. I haven't seen any books written about Canadians in Africa.
Maybe not since the Boer War.
Chinese in Africa. So everything is Chinese. And there is a certain uncomfortable use of vocabulary in that way. And I think the darker side of this is that, you know, there are Chinese corporations, many of whom may be either subsidized or are part owned by the Chinese government, and these are subsidized corporations which operate in Africa, and the evidence suggests that they behave just as well or just as badly as their as the corporations from the U.S. or Canada or elsewhere, and that's hardly surprising. They're in the business of making profits, and they're very clear about that. But they're still in those sectors are still rather small. I think it's much, much more serious to consider Canada and Canadian mining, and you know we talk about Canadian mining and the Canadian mining corporations, which we don't talk about Canadians doing this. This is Canadian corporations, heavily subsidized nowadays by the Harper government to exploit Africa's natural resources, and given a charitable face by very substantive grants of public money from the Harper government to a group of three or four international NGOs who are going to build schools and the like in the areas where these corporations are exploiting labor and extracting resources from these countries, DRC and so on. And it's pretty shocking. And I think the tension needs to be much more on China, because on Canada, because Canada's mining corporations have a terrible reputation in Africa. And indeed, if people care to look at what the same corporations are doing in areas which are of Canada, which are occupied by the First Nations, you will see great parallels between the way they treat the environment and the way they treat labor and communities there, as they do in Africa. And I think that's probably a much, much more serious issue to focus attention on than China. But I think, you know, but as I said, they work in a very similar way. Corporations will tend to do that. If you look at the foreign aid behavior of China and Canada, there are some similarities, but it's very clear that China has put a huge amount aside to help build infrastructure in Africa. And the Harper government has just recently announced, if I recall right, withdrawing from virtually every country in Africa, save one, I think, and only focusing attention on providing public funds for private corporations who are going to be exploiting Africa's natural resources.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'm actually glad that you kind of explained some of that, because it's something on the show that we've talked about is actually the Canadian mining corporations. I mean, it's one of the largest sectors in the world, and Canadian mining companies are some of the most powerful. So I think it is a well taken point that you highlighted all that. I'm also curious too. I mean, moving on to a more recent event in Mali, and you were just explaining it with this whole thing with the indigenous Tuareg trying to get independence of their of northern Mali. Now, I've also noticed in the media, there's always seems to be this talking of the Tuareg. When they talk about it, it's that they have connections to Al Qaeda, and also that the Tuareg fought on the side of Gaddafi in the war in Libya. Do these sort of assertions have, do they hold any water, that they have connections to Al-Qaeda and then they fought for Gaddafi?
Well, there's several issues here. First of all, what we're talking about is a country which used to be part of, by the French, it was part of the Senegal and Mali. There was one place was called the French Sudan. Where in the 1960s, when they achieved independence, Senegal broke away from Mali. So you've already had a change in territory at that time. And then you have this odd place called Mali, which was defined on a map and has no real legitimacy. But there's a huge number of people who are known as the Azawad, and people keep referring to them as the Tuareg. Some of them are indeed Tuareg, and indeed the leadership is of the movement in Mali tends to be from that particular nomadic group. But they are also related to and are part historically of the people who are known as the Imazigen. And the Imazigen are the people who in the West are referred to as Berbers, which is a rather crude word for barbarians. And the Azawad people stretch their territory, where they live, where they've historically lived for centuries, if not millennia, covers the northern parts of Mali, covers Burkina Faso, covers Mauritania, covers Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and so on. It's a huge, vast area that they live in. And there have been four uprisings, at least. I think this is the fifth uprising. The first one was in 1916, the second one in 1961, the third one in 1991, then in 2000, and then again more recently. But the MNLA, the National Movement for the Liberation of the Azawad, is a very interesting secular movement. Which has arisen over the last few years. The problem is in that area. There's also, this is a desert area where a lot goes on, which we don't often know very clearly. But what we do know is that there are at least three other factions which are operating there. One is the Al Qaeda in the Maghreb, AQIM. Which is affiliated to Al Qaeda, and is clearly a very an explicitly jihadist and terrorist organization. The second is the Ansar Din, which is also a similar Islamist movement. The third one is more recent, called the FNLA, which is also has a similar characteristic. Now, what everyone has tried to do is to imply that the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, MNLA, which is the movement which has declared independence, is a terrorist Islamic group. Well, it isn't. It's actually quite secular. Indeed, what's been very interesting is that where AQIM has recently been kidnapping people. There was a large group of Algerians who were kidnapped recently, and it was the MNLA which freed them. Similarly, there were some French people who were arrested, who were kidnapped, and it was the MNLA again who freed them. It's a mess in that sense. But what the MNLA represents is a movement for self-determination. And it's been given a huge push, because I talked earlier on about the effects of structural adjustment. Well, you know, they've had numerous negotiations with the Mali government, and the Mali government signed accords which agreed that funds would be allocated for health services, education, and so on and so forth in the northern areas. That they've always rescinded on. Indeed, the last time they made a budgetary allocation for that, all of that money was used to build military camps and to arm the military. So I think that's a very serious situation where they've been incredibly marginalized. And if you think about the number of people who are destitute in Mali, I mean, there's a huge famine which is developing there. And why is that developing? It's developing because of the way in which these people have been treated, been neglected and disenfranchised. And the disenfranchisement has meant that it has led to discontent. And so you have this movement which has arisen, but it's complicated by the fact that AFRICOM is there and doing all kinds of alliances with people like AQIM. There's AQIM is very clearly involved in acts of terror, rape, and so on, and of kidnapping. And there are a lot of accusations that, for example, Human Rights Watch talked about a rise in the number of rapes. It is entirely unclear who is responsible for that, and which of these particular factions has been involved. But Libya has been constantly being raised as a sort of a motor force for this. Well, actually, what Gaddafi did was to recruit quite a lot of the Azawad and gave them military training. He had this vision that he would support their movement, but he never actually got round to doing it. But they were highly trained people. When Libya collapsed as a result of the NATO invasion, what happened was that many of these people left Libya. And at least half of them ended up in Bamako, in the south, are part of joined the military of the government's military. The others have I think gone to at least I think we the reports are there about 500 went over to the MNLA, and indeed there's about that same number of troops deserted from the Mali government to join the MNLA as well, and so. But why everyone is so intense on condemning and stopping the Azawad is, first of all, that they are challenging the integrity of the colonial borders. Now, Mauritania has people who are from the Azawad. Burkina Faso has. Algeria has. Tunisia has, Morocco has. If that movement starts to happen, then it gives greater credibility for, well, if the Azawad and the MNLA can declare independence, why not us? And I think that the threat, the reason why ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, why they issued a military threat to stop the MNLA was because any threat to the territorial integrity of colonial boundaries is a direct threat to our elites. Because our elites in Africa depend not only on their collaboration with corporations and the international corporations and the banks and so on, their source of accumulation, how they get profits, how they get money into their pockets, into their banks, is by having a territory defined that is their exclusive right to exploit and to accumulate. And that is what is being threatened by the MNLA. And I think that's the challenge that that's why the reaction has been so fierce. On the other hand, that territory that the Azawad have declared as theirs is also a territory which is very rich in oil and gas and possibly other mineral resources as well, which means that there's also a game going on with France saying, well, look, you know, maybe this would give us access to it in a way that we wouldn't otherwise get. So there's some level of inter-imperial rivalry going on there. But it's very clear that when it comes down to it, France would rather have it go back to where it was before. If you look at the Security Council resolution on Mali, it was unanimous, and France and the U.S. all signed on to that.
Well, thank you, Feroz, for actually, I'm looking at the time here, it's just over 40 minutes now. But so I mean, I thank you for that, though, because breaking this all down, getting not only in the wide, more sweeping general ways in which you describe this, but also getting into the specifics is what's really desperately needed to understand this this really actually quite amazing time that we live in. So thank you again for giving your time and coming on and doing the interview for us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show again.
Yes. If the listeners don't know, tell them a bit about Pambazuka News and where they can get some of that information.
Well, Pambazuka News is a Pan-African newsletter for social justice. The website is at www.pambazuka.org. It has a readership of approaching a million people. We have about 3,300 authors across the continent who write for it every week. And it comes out in English, French, and occasionally in Portuguese.
Well, excellent, Froze. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Of course. Have a good day.
And you.
Yeah, bye-bye.